Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 21st of July 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in studio, David Scott.
Very pleased to be here, Brian.
It's really excellent. The only thing we have to say is that since you've been here, David, the weather has taken a turn for the worst. And we open our windows here. It's raining very hard indeed.
It's just to make me feel at home. It's lovely.
Okay. Well, that's a pleasure. Where do we start? Well, I think it's over to Mike Robinson, who's been having a look at matters to do with Russia.
Well, matters to do with what's going on in the United States regarding Russia, because the system seems to have doubled down on this whole Russia messing about with Trump business. So this is Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley. The mainstream media coverage of this is pretty incredible because they can't decide exactly what he's saying. They are portraying this, that he's going to subpoena Donald Trump Jr. And also Paul Manafort if they don't appear before his committee next week. This is on the 26th. And what the mainstream media is portraying this as is Grassley suggesting that the Christopher Steele dossier was the Fusion GPS dossier, that Fusion GPS was actually working for the Russians. If you look a bit deeper into this, there's a bit more to it than it seems. So that's how the mainstream media is portraying it. But what he actually seems to be doing is looking at links between Fusion GPS and the FBI, and particularly Comey. And so they're going to hold this open hearing on this 26th of July on the 2016 dossier on Donald Trump, which was produced by former, in inverted commas, former MI6 operative Christopher Steele. So these are going to be held under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, and they're designed to get a bit more of this business of the Steele dossier out. But as I say, the mainstream media portraying this as being collusion between Fusion GPS and Christopher Steele and the Russian government, which is missing the point completely. But if we move on to the next one, we'll see how the US establishment is doubling down on this, because this is GMF, and they have organized the Alliance for Securing Democracy. It's all the warmongers from the Bush and Obama administrations reorganizing themselves, claiming that Russia is the enemy, and after that comes China. And so this new alliance was formed on the 11th of July. It has two co-chairs. One is the Democrat, Laura Rosenberger, who was foreign policy advisor for Hillary for America in the 2016 general election. And the other is Jamie Fly, who's a Republican, who was an advisor to Marco Rubio, to Bush Jr. And while Bush Jr. was president, he was working for the Defense Department and was a National Security Council official. And who else is involved with this? The likes of Bill Kristol, Mike Chertoff, Michael Morell, Jake Sullivan, and all the neocons that were around the Project for a New American Century. So they are pushing this forward. Their mission statement says, finding out what happened in the United States in 2016 and the impact it had is important, but that is not enough. Russia's efforts are also ongoing across Europe, and we need to prepare for other state actors to replicate Putin's tactics. Meeting this challenge to our democracy demands that Republicans and Democrats in the United States unite with our democratic allies around the world to better understand Russia's multifaceted aggression in order to defend ourselves and our democratic partners and deter such activity in the future. So they are absolutely going for this. No matter how many times this rhetoric and this narrative has been discredited, they're going for it as hard as they can, Brian.
It's really quite incredible, Mike, isn't it? And I was just reading the first part of the their statement there, which said that the US Intelligence Committee had assessed in 2017 that Moscow will apply lessons learnt from its Putin-ordered campaign aimed at the US presidential elections. From all the material I've seen, although this so-called campaign has been talked about, there has never been any evidence produced by the American or the British intelligence services that there was ever a campaign by the Russians to interfere with the US elections or indeed any of the electoral process in UK. Am I incorrect? Have I missed something? But this whole website to me seems to be based on a lie.
Everything's based on a lie, it seems, at the moment.
This is where the work of Project Veritas, who infiltrated CNN, is so important, because they have the covert video of CNN executives saying, well, the whole Russia thing, it's a nothing burger. We've got nothing, there's no evidence, there's no smoking gun, but we're pushing this, we're pushing it for ratings, and we're going to keep pushing it. But they admitted there's no evidence. There's nothing there. There's nothing to substantiate this at all. Their hope is, if they keep going long enough, that eventually, in a very interconnected world, where people talk to other people all the time, they'll be able to cobble together something that looks credible. And so far, there's no sign of that at all.
I'll just add to that. It's interesting that our news has been put together today, and as always, individuals have taken particular subjects, but the theme of it, to my mind, appears to be the fact that increasingly we're seeing our own governments lie to the population, whether that's the US government, certainly the British government. We're seeing the governments lie, conducting policies which have never been voted upon. And of course, one of the areas suffering is human rights and true democracy.
Well, this absolutely follows on from the previous story, because it is the Human Rights and Democracy Report for 2016, which was released yesterday by the Foreign Commonwealth Office. And of course, they say that promoting human rights is a central foreign policy objective of the British government. They say the Foreign and Commonwealth Office began publishing its annual human rights report in 1998, and it has now published online, as well as the annual report, twice yearly updates on the 30 countries of interest. Now, they are calling these human rights priority countries, and these are countries which the UK looks to for positive engagement that contributes to addressing human rights concerns. And the 30 human rights priority countries are Afghanistan, Bahrain, Bangladesh, Burma, Burundi, Central African Republic, China, Colombia, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Democratic Republic of Congo, Egypt, Eritrea, Iran, Iraq, Israel, the occupied Palestinian territories, Libya, Maldives, Pakistan, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, South Sudan, Sri Lanka, Sudan, Syria, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Venezuela, Yemen, and Zimbabwe. So Israel isn't included on that list, as you're probably not surprising to many. But if we move on to the next one, there is a quote here, because this is what the report says about Russia. It says, the UK was deeply concerned about the ongoing crackdown on civil society and freedom of expression. The government of Russia, that is, increasingly used legislation to restrict civil society organizations, including broadening the definition of political activity under the Foreign Agents Law, the introduction of the Yarovaya Law in July, aimed at tackling religious extremism, resulted in increased restrictions of online freedoms. So let's just have a quick look at this.
We cannot allow this ideology the safe space it needs to breed. Yet that is precisely what the internet and the big companies that provide internet-based services provide. We need to work with allied democratic governments to reach international agreements that regulate cyberspace.
So, Brian and David, the question has to be, How can the, with a straight face, the Foreign Office criticise Russia's human rights record and shutting down or increasing restrictions of online freedoms in order to tackle religious extremism in Russia, while at the same time doing exactly the same in the UK?
Well, my instant answer to that, Mike, is that we are ruled by liars, criminals and fraudsters. So the truth doesn't actually feature with the British government at the moment. Yes, I looked at the quote there from the British government in relation to Russia. And yet it was the British government that was injecting those non-government organisations into Russia. And those organisations were clearly working in a subversive way. The Russian security services clearly identified this, and ultimately people were kicked out. I believe Jon Kinnock was one of the people removed by the Russians for activities, nefarious activities inside Russia. But you're absolutely right, unbelievable hypocrisy by the British government. And as we mentioned yesterday, we had BBC's very own charity, BBC Media Action, where senior members involved with that were boasting that the BBC was working inside Syria to help destabilise the government. I mean, it's sorry, David, it's almost difficult to comment on this because the hypocrisy is so blatant.
Well, on the subject of blatant hypocrisy, the other thing you mentioned there, Mike, is broadening the definition of political activity. And that immediately brings to mind the famous David Cameron quote, who said to us all, "For too long we've been a passively tolerant society, saying to our people, as long as you obey the law, we will leave you alone." Now, if that's not broadening political activity into all aspects of life, what is?
Yeah. So this is sheer hypocrisy, but it shows how dangerous I think that the British government is, because once you get to this stage of hypocrisy, of lying, of propaganda, the government can be trusted on no other issue. And perhaps we can bring in this lady, article from Legal Cheek, but apparently people are getting excited in Scotland, David, because we've got a lady president of the Supreme Court. Should we trust these judges to administer law?
Well, I mean, Lady Hale has a pretty good reputation. She obviously was in the part of the judgment on named person, and she may be a reformer. We will have to see. But there's a lot to reform. There is no register of judicial interests in the legal system in this country. There's none in Scotland. There's none for the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court doesn't even have a register of recusals where judges have withdrawn because of a conflict of interest. That's not recorded. So the aspects of the interests of the judges, of where they hold, for example, stocks and shares, of their investments, of areas where their private concerns might influence their public duty. These things are opaque, and they need to be transparent in order to build confidence. The confidence that's been so badly eroded with so many cases of failure of the justice system in this country.
And an example of that would be Peter Watson, formerly of Levy and McRae Solicitors, who was also a part-time judge as well in Scotland. Of course, he was implicated in the Heather capital fraud. Do we know what's happened in that case? I haven't heard any.
It's still ongoing, Brian. The case is still continuing. The look into Levy and McRae, and that would include Peter Watson, is ongoing, and the money is still missing.
The money is still missing, but we should trust the judges. And of course, the politicians are all too keen always to push public inquiries in the hands of judges, because these are apparently people we should trust. At that point, let's bring on a man we haven't seen on the sort of stage for a while, and that's Gordon Brown. But he's been giving information to the so-called Independent Child Abuse Inquiry, where he suddenly raised the issue of forced child migration and says it's a bigger abuse scandal than Savile. This is part of the BBC report here. Let's bring in the next bit. He told the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse that the 2,000 surviving British child migrants who suffered abuse should be compensated. We're not going to deal with how they were abused and who was responsible. We're going to compensate them. Should they be compensated? Yes, but what's going on here is buying off of people, I'd suggest. The mass transportation of 130,000 British children overseas was government-enforced trafficking. And across 50 years, the children were sent to ex-colonies such as Australia. They also went out to Canada. I believe, David, that this is an immensely cynical piece of manipulation to get people's attention away from the real root of the government in Britain covering up the abuse of children. No explanations as how Jimmy Savile was able to be so close to senior politicians and the royal family, access to abuse people inside hospitals even and prisons. We're now going to dig up another subject to distract people. That's the way I see it.
And it's safely out of the way. It's safely out of the way geographically, and it's out of the way in terms of time, because this is all safely in the past. And the idea that we're looking into failures of the past, not failures of the present, is perpetrated all the time by government inquiries and politicians.
Exactly. So let's have a look at this. We'll put this on as the headline, and the headline is how the British state covers up child abuse. Now, I have a report here. We've been following this case for some time. We can only give a snapshot of it because part of it is still going on inside the court system. But interestingly enough, this centres on Sheffield. And Sheffield, of course, says that it's a city that welcomes refugees. It's a city of sanctuary for those refugees. And this is the report that's been sent through to us. We can only give you these bullet points because this is an ongoing case. But already a member of South Yorkshire Police has been removed from their position because of their collusion in a whole series of events, including perjury, the covering up of information, and the failure to protect children. We've got here in a letter written by a police solicitor and sent in the name of the senior officer, it was made clear that they, the police, had no intention of pursuing a video and sound recording showing child abuse, threats to kill, fraud and extortion. So the police, given that video and sound recording, and all of a sudden South Yorkshire Police are backtracking. They don't want to follow the case. The solicitor for the mother refuses to use the evidence against the father, who is a convicted sex offender and convicted violent fraudster. The judge simply refused to allow this evidence in court. So that's how you control the court case. The barrister for the mother threatened her that if she talks to others, she will drop the case. The solicitor's regulation authority refused to take action against the bent solicitors who are covering up the child abuse. The judge has failed to prosecute the council social worker for perjury. The Office of Judicial Complaints has refused to prosecute the judge, but they cannot dispute the evidence. The Independent Child Abuse Inquiry, which we've just seen Gordon Brown has been speaking to, has admitted that the evidence they received was simply sent straight back to South Yorkshire Police, who were failing to do their job in the first place. The inquiry has said that they will archive the material, but have shown no interest in actually doing anything. The police commissioner's office refuses to acknowledge receipt of the evidence and have failed to reply to requests for a meeting. And if we just ended up here, the chief constable has failed to respond to emails despite his public promise to do so. And the last one is that CAFCAS have failed to act upon the same video evidence. And we'll be mentioning CAFCAS a little bit later when we talk about baby Charlie Gard. I wish I could give more evidence to put in front of our viewers and listeners today, but I can't do that because parts of this case are ongoing. But we felt that this has got to such a state that we've had to put out these bullet points to give people indications of what is really going on in the child protection and court system of UK.
the thing that strikes me most about it, Brian, is how familiar this is. This idea that you go in front of a court, you get yourself legal representation. You have a barrister, you have a big legal team, and there's a huge struggle for people to get that far. And then what they find is the barrister and the legal team are operating in someone else's interests. The individuals find that they are, in fact, the poorer for having all this legal representation, because the truth is simply excluded, and that there is another agenda at work. And then they're seeing that that agenda is reflected in the decisions, often of the judge as well, and the police, and they start talking about how is this happening? You know, where is justice in our country? Where this goes on?
Sorry to interject there. And we are lecturing other countries on the world stage as to how they should run their countries. We are criticising them because we say they don't have a justice system. But this is the reality about what's going on in UK.
What some of the cases I've been following in Scotland have shown is you can see the honest people in the system. You can see them because they're actually trying to subvert their own system. They're trying to help the other side in a court case. Or they're making, in one case, a judge made it clear by the questions that the judge asked of a defence team in court. The judge revealed to the individual person who was represented by that defence team that in the previous hearing, where the individual wasn't there and the defence team were, the lawyers have been acting against these instructions and against his interests. So you can see the honest people trying to highlight it, trying to reveal it where they can. But the system as a whole seems to be working far too often against the interests of justice, not for it.
Against the interests of justice. Well, we're going to move on to talk a little bit more about Grenfell Tower. I think I'm right in saying that the new leader of the council is herself a child services.
She came from Kensington Council's. She had a position on what they call their cabinet, and that position was looking after children services and family services. Yes.
Right. So a person involved with child family services is now attempting to run the show with regard to events around Grenfell Tower. Interesting. Well, this man has been speaking out. We've got Sajid Javid on the government website saying that he's made his third oral statement, I think, on Grenfell.
He has, and it's very interesting. I encourage people to look this out and read the whole statement. It goes through the situation with regards to buildings, with regards to survivors of the fire, and how the arrangements for managing the situation are progressing. Many interesting little snippets. He says it's now they're now confident that no more than 203 high-rise blocks in England have this form of aluminium composite material, flammable cladding, and this is blocks above 18 metres high, which is a height referred to in the building regulations. Interestingly enough, it's not the height that the manufacturer for this material regards as safe. That would be 10 metres. That's an interesting sort of little wrinkle to it. And he also makes threats of coercive action to force this situation to be corrected. And he talks about the ongoing testing. And the testing's very interesting and quite logical, because what the testing is now doing is it's looking at large-scale mock-ups of overcladding systems, looking at the combination of the aluminium composite material cladding, the flammable cladding, polyethylene core cladding, and the different insulation products sitting behind it. So what they're looking for is what we reported on the first day after the fire, is the interaction between the highly flammable cladding that allows flame to spread quickly and the combustible insulation behind, which generates smoke and flammable gases, and is the entire combination being uniquely dangerous. They're looking to find out if there are some combinations of cladding and insulation that are less dangerous, so that we might avoid stripping all the cladding from 203 blocks and maybe only strip it from a smaller number. You know, these are the issues that are being explored.
But we have to say that it's interesting that these tests are now being done now with hindsight of the fire.
Absolutely. Yes, these are all new tests. These were not part of the building regulation environment
originally. Well, let's bring the Huffington Post on here because I found this fascinating. Sajid Javid mentioned here, ready to name and shame over Grenfell cladding tests. But what this article also said is that apparently we, the British, we just can't cope with the fact that there's been a serious fire in a tower block, and we're going to have to bring in 9/11 experts in order to help us unravel what's actually happening in the building. I always find this sort of thing quite remarkable, that as a nation that stood on its own for quite a long time, we've now got to the point apparently that we can't really run anything ourselves. We have to bring in this new body of experts. And it seems to me we didn't fully get to the bottom of 9/11. Why would we want to use 9/11 fire people in this instance?
Yes, 9/11 police investigation because of the size of the crime scene. So it's now been declared a crime scene. And the scale of it is such that the only comparable thing is 9/11. But of course, one of the main features of 9/11 was the disruption of the crime scene, the rapid demolition of the crime scene, and the shipping of the material
overseas.
Yeah. So if you're looking for an example of how not to investigate a large crime scene, 9/11 is that example. And yet, this is what we're bringing into Grenfell.
It seems to me that it's helping to muddy the waters. But let's turn to the BBC, and I found this an extremely, extremely unpleasant interview. This is Mr. Lammy, and Neil... Andrew Neil. Yeah, we got there in the end. Did the interview. So Mr. Lammy's saying that he was deeply, deeply upset by what had happened, apart from anything else, because he'd lost a friend in the building. But he was also saying he'd spent a lot of time talking to survivors, and he was very interested in what those survivors had to say to him. Including that they were saying that they watched people jumping out of windows, and particularly they did not recognise the official figure that was being given of 80 deaths at the moment. If we just follow through what was said, and then we can talk about it. But essentially, David Lammy said this: residents are suspicious over the official death toll. There have been instances in the past, Hillsborough, for example, where the authorities have not told the truth, and the truth has taken nearly 30 years to come out. And nobody can argue with that. We now have evidence to show that where necessary, the British government and local authorities will lie to cover up large crime scenes. So that's what he had to say. And he was talking with passion, reasonable passion and emotion, because as he said, he'd been spending time with the survivors. And then here's Andrew Neil, and he was just outrageous. The fact that residents had sent anything, according to this man, was not evidence.
This is so it, yes, victim, first-hand victim testimony.
Is not evidence.
Is not evidence.
No. So at one point, Mr. Lammy said, well, actually, if you were running a court, you'd want to know what people said. No, this is not evidence, said Neil. We need evidence to show that the official death toll is far too low, and even the victims don't have it. So the arrogance here was just unbelievable. And then eventually he got into an accusatory mantra of "you are playing politics," was all he kept saying to this man. This some people have described it as a car crash interview, but I found it obscene.
Yeah, I think obscene is the right word. This "you are playing politics, you are playing politics." There's been a lot of playing politics over Grenfell. There has, but this was not it. This was a representative from the local community doing exactly what he should do, which is talking and listening to the local community and bringing what they are saying to a wider audience. This was not playing politics. This was a man doing his job. And he was rounded on by Andrew Neil, who basically accused him of anything he could to silence the view that was being put forward that the 80 figure might be dodgy. The raising a question over that, saying that the people on the ground cannot accept this figure because it just doesn't tally with their experience of who lived in that block.
Yeah.
That information must not be allowed, it would seem, to be broadcast.
According to the BBC.
Without being immediately rounded on and condemned as some sort of political game, which it's clearly not.
Yeah. So let's remind ourselves that Andrew Neil did feature in the recent pay release from the BBC. So the BBC has published details of... this is Andrew Neil himself saying this. The BBC has published details of on-screen talent, which you may be surprised to know includes me as on-screen talent. And apparently he's in the £200,000 to £249,999 bracket. So vast amounts of money paid for this man to be unbelievably rude and condescending to an elected member of parliament who had taken the trouble to go and talk to survivors. And one of Lammy's points was, of course, to Andrew Neil, have you actually been there to talk to survivors? But Neil didn't want to answer that question.
Indeed not.
So we've got this man now on scene, Assistant Metropolitan Police Commissioner Craig Mackey, and he said that the investigation was going to be one of the largest and most complex in the Met's history, but he would be guessing if you had to put a time frame on arrest. So you've mentioned this is a crime scene. We've got Craig Mackey, policeman, saying that people are going to be arrested, but he doesn't know when. But we haven't yet collected all the evidence, and we don't know how many people died.
And we don't actually know what the charge might be. I mean, he's talking about arrest and saying he doesn't have a time frame in arrest, but it seems to be, from that, the expectation that there will be arrests.
Yeah.
Now, this begs the question, who and on what charge? Because what's actually happened here has happened in 203 other tower blocks across England. And the people... one would assume that are responsible in Grenfell are the ones who are unlucky compared to the 203 other cases where the same tragedy could have very easily occurred.
Right. And I know you're going to move us on in a moment to some examples in Scotland of these types of fires. But I just want to put this on screen. This is the question which the BBC does not want to ask. It dare not ask. And that is why the Grenfell survivors have not been assembled. So all brought back together. And I've used a military expression there, but debriefed. They're brought together and questioned about their assessment of the occupancy of the tower at the time of the fire. Who were the best people to know how many people were in that block at the time? People who lived there. They knew, because they lived there, at what time of day, what day of the week, the number of people likely to be in the tower. And this was the key thing, that once this had been done, at least you had a figure to work on. I can say that certainly on board a warship, and it applied when an American ship had a collision with a tanker recently out in close to the coast of Japan. The first thing that happened on board after that a collision was they assembled the crew to establish how many people were missing, how many people were under not accounted for. And as a result of that very simple action, they knew they were looking for about seven crew members that... they said, where are these people? So this is a very simple principle, but what's happened in Grenfell is the exact opposite. People have been dispersed, which means that key assessment by the local people has been thrown away. Now, this is the thing I was referring to, and you identified this from the Scottish News, but we've had a pattern of these tower block fires.
Yes, the most interesting of all of these is the 1999 example. This is Garrick Court in Irvine. Now, this is huge similarities with Grenfell, much smaller scale, of course. But what happened here? The yellow cladding you see there is a series of it's not an overcladding. It's part of the original construction of the building, but for architectural reasons, rather than having a concrete panel on the outside of the building, at the corners, they had this yellow cladding panel. And what happened was there was a fire in the fourth floor, and that very rapidly spread 9 stories upwards in 5 minutes. The firemen fighting this described how physically difficult it was and dangerous it was to fight the fire, because despite having ample fire appliances, ladders, and a lot of people that got out from various floor levels via ladders, they had to carry the hoses up, because you've got to fight the fire from inside. They had to carry the hoses up the stairwells. They couldn't use the lifts, obviously. They had to, as they came in and out of the building, there was fallen debris landing on them. There was fallen debris landed on one of the fire engines that couldn't be moved because it was pumping water at the time. So this was a mini Grenfell, and this was 1999, and there was a parliamentary inquiry, and the regulations in Scotland were changed. Whether they were changed to the correct answer is another matter, but there was a response. So another example of the risk being known and really being illustrated in very stark terms.
Yeah, and yet at the moment, everybody in authority seems to be terribly surprised that this happened, and nobody's too sure who's responsible, and we're not too sure about the building regulations, and we've got to retest materials. This is just a systematic failure.
It is, but the arrests, I would predict, if they occur at all, will be at much lower level.
Yes, the central government won't be at fault in any way. No. We heard reports that calls for improved fire safety were simply dismissed by a whole succession of senior government members. They won't be at fault. It will be pinned at fairly low level on somebody well down the food chain. Well, we just put on screen an advert for a gathering and a talk at the Maxilla Social Club. UK Column has offered to go and talk about some of these issues and answer questions. A very relaxed format. We're not sure who is going to be there or who will ultimately be speaking, but we are going to avail ourselves to local people to answer questions on what we know from your side. David, you've obviously got the professional experience as a structural engineer. And we also have information about how some of these regeneration areas have worked, including suppressing really local communities in order to get the bigger government policy going through. So I think it's going to be an extremely interesting day. And if anybody can attend that, to Maxilla Walk, W106ST. We would love to see you there. But as I say, the actual format for that afternoon, very flexible, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Well, let's just end on really rights of children. I think it comes down to, and we're coming back on the story of Charlie Gard. Now, we showed this yesterday. We'll just recap on this. We picked up on the article that said they were feeling very uncomfortable that CAF CAS had appointed a barrister, Mrs. Butler Cole, to look after young Charlie Gard's interests. Parents were slightly distressed, I think, to discover that this lady was chairman of a Compassion in Dying group. And remember that doctors at Great Ormond Street have basically said this child should be allowed to die. We pointed out that CAF CAS was in no way independent, because here was one of the memoranda of understanding with the family courts. We've got this article here from the Telegraph that Charlie Gard's parents have been back in the High Court as a judge has supposedly analysed new evidence. And then we've also got this one, that Charlie Gard granted permanent resident in the US by Congress and can fly to America for treatment. It's just amazing that there is such a saga has to go on before a child can receive treatment that somebody is offering. And the state feels the need to block the parents, indeed start to separate the parents from their child, in order to prevent the child having a possible treatment. How does this work, David? Because I still don't know what the mentality is.
It's very difficult to understand, actually, where the decision-making comes from. Is it on one possibility? Is it what we're seeing here is a demand by the state that ultimately the children are children of the state, that the parents are there to do a job for the state rather than the other way around.
Yeah, they can bring the children up as long as they're bringing the children up as the state requires.
And when the state decides that you are going to be too difficult to save and you should be allowed to die, then the state must make that decision. Is that it? Is it the arrogance of the medical profession, having made these decisions for too long and forgetting that they are there to serve people? I think at the very heart of it, it's an attack on the family and on the rights of parents and on the ability of parents to make these decisions, despite the fact that, including places like the Supreme Court, they've pointed out that that the state has no business making these decisions. It's no business of the state how we bring up our children, and it's no business of the state, really, where we go in order to make decisions to get medical attention.
Yeah.
And the thing that struck me most severely is we've been through this just recently. We've had the Asher King case, where we've had all of these problems explored. We had a family who were seeking medical attention for their son, vilified, criminalised, arrested, dragged off in handcuffs. But fortunately, the grandmother of the child managed to get a video out on YouTube and it went viral, and people started to realise there was more to this story than they were being told. And it transpires that the Asher King's family were absolutely right. This medical intervention that wasn't being offered on the NHS is now being offered on the NHS as a result. Asher King has recovered and is doing very well and is attending school, but the parents very wisely are staying in Spain, and who can blame them?
And for them to stay in Spain, this is fear, isn't it?
They've got
to be fearful of the system in UK, that they come back, they're going to be attacked in that sense, or they're going to have the children taken away from them, or the child taken away. Fear. People are in fear of the system in UK, and yet we have the same UK government lecturing countries overseas on how they should run their societies.
No, this international manhunt, this taking away of loving parents in shackles, this was prompted by the doctors in the Asher King case. They did not have any prosecution. They did not see any disciplinary action. Nothing happened to them. There was no negative consequences for these doctors. So now we're seeing the whole thing repeated again. The medical profession and the government and the courts have learned nothing from the first case, and we're simply rerunning the same situation. It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Let's leave that one there. And we'll just end on a nautical subject, because apparently we can now relax. We've got our aircraft carrier at sea. It doesn't have any aircraft, but that's just details, because of course it's a little bit better than a cyber ship. But now we're getting exciting, because the steel has been cut on HMS Glasgow. This is a historic milestone for the Royal Navy. We don't have enough frigates to protect the £3.5 billion aircraft carrier, so we're just going to launch a £1.3 billion warship in order to help that situation, and we may get some other warships in the future. Here's Michael Fallon, because he's the only person you see now mentioned in defence matters. He's pointing, if you have a look at the little inset picture, and what's he pointing at? Well, I believe that this is the first bit of steel being cut, and apparently...
Swedish steel.
Well, I've heard that actually a greater proportion of the steel is now going to be British, because apparently the government's got a little bit squeamish over people saying, actually, this is not helping British industry if we use overseas steel. No mention of missile systems for this ship, because, of course, we know that fairly shortly British warships will be at sea without any surface-to-surface missiles. But presumably that's a minor detail, because they're going to digitally enhance them or something.
Well,
The prize, I think, this week goes to the Times for a piece of journalism which I think is just appalling. We've got an article which is based on hearsay that a reception in the Downing Street garden for members of the LGBT community, Theresa May was overheard chatting to two submariners, and they complained that when they were at sea, they didn't get enough bandwidth to download whatever they wanted to from the internet. And then one of these people allegedly said, well, the real problem was they couldn't download the porn they wanted. So this is hearsay, this is allegation. It's pushed out by the Times as if this is print-worthy. I just read it and I looked at it and I looked at the journalist Patrick Kidd and I thought, this is where the Times has now got to. This is not news. This is fake news. This is, what is it, manipulating people's minds.
I think it's called clickbait.
Clickbait, okay.
It's to get easy attention on the internet with titillating nonsense that actually doesn't signify
which distracts anything. People from the real issues.
Yeah.
Okay, David, thank you very much for joining us. We'll leave it there. We will say thank you very much to all of our viewers and listeners who give us the support that they do. Once again, if you're not a subscriber for UK Column, then please consider taking out a subscription, because we can only do what we do with your financial support. David, it's been great to have you in the studio. Also, Alex Thompson. We've had the opportunity for a face-to-face discussion, which has been very productive. Interesting to see that the reports coming in from different parts of the country are more and more people beginning to realise that something is wrong, more and more people realising that they cannot trust their own governments, they cannot trust their own local authorities, and this means that we are heading into very dangerous territory, but at least the truth is now coming to the surface, and I think that gives us the weapon to deal with these people.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. It's been fascinating. It's moving forward. I see a lot of new ideas and a lot of new equipment, and it's a lot of activity and buzz about the office that wasn't there a wee while ago. It's very heartening to see the progress.
Thanks very much. That's it from us. Bye bye.